The Feast of Fools is brought to you by generous support of fantastic, fabulous, incredible people just like you.
Without your support, we really couldn't do this show, so please visit feastoffools.net and make a donation. Buy a t-shirt today.
Your financial contributions mean the world to us.
Thank you for your support. And the Feast of Fools is also brought to you in part by LifeLube.org, the gay, sexy, and healthy website and blog. Always fresh, LifeLube covers the stuff you care about most.
There's plenty of eye candy and a little bit of silly packed into this fun and informative site. LifeLube, the sticky stuff that keeps gay men together.
Free, easy, and beautiful, just like you, my darlings.
Click LifeLube.org for the website and LifeLube.blogspot.com for the blog. Whatever you do, click early and often. It's the podcast that keeps on giving and giving until it hurts. The Feast of Fools. On today's show, join us for a lively discussion at the Center on Halsted in Chicago, Illinois, about gay men's relationship to sex and risk.
The forum features panel experts Dr. David Halperin, Dr. Gary Harper, and Dr. Michelle Morales, as well as LifeLube's Jim Pickett, and questions from you, the general public.
Discover some of the inaccurate and damaging psychological concepts that are being used to describe gay men.
What do we all ultimately desire?
I'm Fausto Furnos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is the music of John Close. The song Walk Through the River from his album Black Box EP is available on our website, feastoffools.net.
Stay tuned.
Never ebbs, never flows, but I'll see you again this way. Oh, it's just another rainy, rainy day, with the bright light shining right through the misty haze, on the ones that are coming, on the ones that leave, and on the ones
good evening. I'm Courtney Reed, and I'm the Senior Director of Programs here at Center on Halsted. And I want to welcome you to our first Project CRISC Community Forum. So what do gay men want anyway? As a lesbian, I've wondered this question for many, many years. And many of you may as well. So we're really ready tonight for an evening of lively dialogue and hope that you'll bring your best selves forward with questions and comments and dialogue and debate as we engage our speakers and each other in really answering this question in a thoughtful way. And maybe I'll have my answer after all these years. Part of the center's strategic priorities, one of our real goals, is to be a convener of the community. And I see this as such an amazing way to bring groups of people together to talk about issues of importance and concern for all of us. And so it's great to see all of you here. And I'm going to turn it over now to our fearless leader, Jim Pickett, from the AIDS Foundation of Chicago.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, can I just say how exciting it is to see such a beautiful, diverse, lovely, interesting crowd? So give yourselves a hand for being here, for eating free food, without water. So I just want to give some basic information about like what the hell is LifeLube, what is Project CRISP, who our partners are, what this is all supposed to be about, and some basic kind of rules of engagement. And then I'll introduce our fearless podcasters, the Feast of Fools, and then the night will get underway. First of all, I want to explain what LifeLube and Project CRISP are really briefly. LifeLube is an online portal. It's a website and a blog. Many of you who RSVP'd had to go there to do that. It's gay men's health website, gay, sexy, healthy, just like many of you, all of us, really. And Project CRISP is a new collaboration funded by the Chicago Department of Public Health, including the Center on Halsted, the AIDS Foundation of Chicago, where I work, Test Positive Aware Network, and Howard Brown Health Center to engage the community around crystal meth, but also around just being a healthier community, promoting holistic health, not focusing on one thing or another, but kind of our whole bodies, our whole holistic, beautiful selves. So this is a new project, and part of what we're doing are some community forums like this. This is the first. We will have many more. Our next one is actually set for June 12th. It'll be through those doors. There's actually a theater in there if you haven't been up here before. We'll be in that theater on June 12th. What we'll be talking about, not exactly sure, but you have evaluation forms on your chairs. So give us your ideas, and that will help determine what we talk about at that forum and future forums. I am now going to bring on your fearless podcasters, Mark Fellian and Fausto Furnos of the Feast of Fools.
Great turnout.
Oh, how fabulous. Mark, wow. Make yourself comfortable. We're at the Center on Halsted. Finally. Oh, so let's do another applause.
Yay.
So for those of you who made, they're like, podcast? What is that? So you have an iPod, which is a portable little device that you can listen to music or talk radio shows. Some NPR programs are podcasted, and the Feast of Fools is podcasted. So you can just type in gay and go to the iTunes Music Store and subscribe to all our shows. We do 5 shows a week.
You can also just visit our website, feastoffools.net, and you can listen to the show right from your computer.
And we want to thank you so much for coming today to our event. Good sex, bad sex, what do gay men want anyway?
Yay. Good sex, bad sex.
Oh.
You're not gonna stop it. We're not talking about our honeymoon, are we? The good sex, bad sex part.
All these beautiful men and women here, and we're not gonna get a little bit personal.
Well, Oh, maybe a little personal, right? Who do you want to get personal with?
What do you do for a living? You're an AIDS activist? Oh, I'd like for you to aid me in a little activity.
Fausto, nobody wants to see a tired Mae West routine.
You're a plumber, huh? I have some pipes that you can help me flush out. An architect, let's go erect something big.
Oh, come on. All right, Fausto, enough with the Mae West.
I thought all that gay men wanted was divas.
No, they don't want divas. They want sex. Lots and lots of sex.
You know, sex is just like pizza. No matter how bad it is, still pretty good. Am I right?
I like that one, but you know what I like too? This is what I like. You know what? Sex is like baseball. Everybody can play baseball, but how many people really make it to the World Series? You know? Not that many.
You have to have talent for that.
You
gotta
be talent.
You. I think a lot of you guys have a lot of talent here. You know, you can take a dick up your ass, but it takes a lot of skill and thoughtfulness to actually talk with your partner about protecting yourself. But what are some of the things that we are struggling with today? I mean, it's 2008. We've been in and out and discussing HIV, AIDS, and drug abuse for decades.
I think this is a huge problem that we've had for a long, long time. I was just on YouTube the other day, and of course, you know, I'm looking for sex, so I found something called Sex Madness. Yes, it's like reefer madness. And this was made in 1934, so this is 70-some years ago. that people were talking about
70 years ago.
Another disease. It was syphilis at the time, but I was so captured by the intro to it. And they wrote down, they said, down through the ages has rushed a menace more dangerous than the worst criminal. Syphilis, let us seize the monster and stamp out forever this horrible influence. Syphilis must no longer play its deadly part in our lives, preventing marriages, breaking up families, and resulting in innocent offspring born blind, diseased, or maimed, doomed to a life of misery. The subject of syphilis must no longer be hushed, but must be fought in the open like any other dangerous, contagious disease. Humanity must be enlightened. Ignorance must be abolished. Young and old, rich and poor, they must be told. And so here we are 70-some years later fighting a very similar contagion.
But you didn't read
disease.
That like sort of like reefer madness.
Well,
you know?
I tried.
They must be told.
They must be told.
We must be. Are we really like scaring ourselves silly? What exactly are we trying to do here? Are we wanting to live the happiest, healthiest, sex-positive lives we can? And it's not all bad news.
No.
But check it out. I mean, I was wondering if we actually had universal health care in this country. You know, Hillary and Barack Obama are running for president. They're really going to be one of our two next presidents.
Hopefully. Let's cross
our
fingers.
You guys can applaud now.
Yay.
And what strikes me is both of them are very aggressive about
healthcare.
Providing universal health care to every citizen and every person that's standing on U.S. soil. But I'm wondering, is that going to alleviate some of our problems? What are some of the people in other countries doing? Well, I was kind of tooling around on the internet, my research center, and I was sort of looking at a study from the University of Melbourne in Australia that was done in 2003, talked about men who ejaculate more than 5 times a week were a third less likely to develop prostate cancer later in life. Men could reduce their risk of developing prostate cancer through regular masturbation.
Ooh, that's like that's
that's something to be happy about.
That's like a pill.
That's like a pill, you know? You got, your hand is a pill.
I love curing cancer.
They say that cancer-causing chemicals build up in your prostate, which is this gland down here, and if you don't ejaculate regularly, it could raise your chances of developing cancer. And sexual intercourse may not have the same protective effect because of the possibility of contracting sexually transmitted diseases, which increase your chances of getting cancer. So everybody tonight, go home and rub one out for cancer.
Yay.
Amen. Hey, women.
But be your own best friend.
What are we really wanting here? I mean, it's like, because the mind of a gay man is a tricky labyrinth, right?
Mm.
So you go like online and you see those lists, like the 10 hottest men that gay men find hottest. And who's on the top of the list?
David Beckham.
Who do you guys find? David Beckham's on the top of the list.
Yes.
Jake Gyllenhaal. These are sexually identified straight men that we are fascinated by. So what does it say about gay men that we're fascinated by predominantly white, straight identified Hollywood movie stars as our sexual desire? Are these lists like screwed up, or are we really seeking out something that's different from us?
The thing you can't have, perhaps.
So, anyways, this is where we go into talking about our fabulous panel of experts. Sexperts and sexy experts.
Please decide which one's which.
You can decide for yourselves. Please give it up for Dr. Michelle Morales. Come over here, sweetie. Dr. Michelle Morales is the Director of Health Education at Northwestern University, formerly a substance abuse therapist and social worker. Her research challenges the claim, listen closely, that GLBT people have higher rates of unhealthy behaviors, including substance abuse, than their heterosexual counterparts. While acknowledging the real problems that face our communities, she examines the way scientific research may be making us sick. Mm. Everybody can go, ooh. Right?
And our next contestant is Dr. Gary Harper. Come on. G- Gary Harper is a professor at the Department of Psychology and the director of Masters of Public Health Program of DePaul University. He spent over 2 decades in the United States and in Africa working with young people and learning, preventing, and treating HIV and AIDS.
What a fabulous man. And please give it up for Dr. David Halperin, our featured guest today. It's fabulous. Dr. David Halperin just came out with a fantastic new book, What Do Gay Men Want? An Essay on Sex, Risk, and Subjectivity. He presents a new approach to describing the lives of gay men, the inner lives, the secret lives, right? What are our desires? What are our passions? What are our interests? And what are some of the cliches that are being used in dealing with HIV and AIDS and substance abuse? He's currently the W.H. Auden Collegiate Professor of the History of Theory of Sexuality at the University of Michigan, and he's fabulous. So please. So let's listen first to Dr. Michelle Morales talk about some of the ways that our research is making us sick.
I'm here to talk primarily about a double bind that's facing scientists and practitioners in our communities. And that double bind is this. It's important that we acknowledge the real problems that we're facing, and I'm speaking particularly about substance abuse and abuse, because that's my area of specialty. At the same time, that sometimes acknowledging those problems or reproducing research and discourse on those problems may actually be constructing the idea that we are not well as a community. So many of you are familiar with the idea that LGBT people have higher rates of substance use and abuse. You may be surprised to know that that idea has been around as long as the identity of homosexuality. And it, in fact, it emerged over 100 years ago at that same time, the same time that the identity of the alcoholic and the addict emerged. It used to be that those were considered behaviors rather than an inherent way of being. And it isn't coincidental that the homosexual and the alcoholic emerged as identities at the same time and through many of the same processes. So for over 100 years, scientists have been wondering, why is it that gay people have higher rates of alcoholism and problems related to substance use? And there are a couple of different ways to look at this. One is to say, wow, is it something inherent, something organic about us as, and I guess I shouldn't say us, let me narrow it down to gay and bisexual men for the purpose of tonight's discussion. Is there something inherent? Genetic researchers are actually asking this question right now that would lend itself to higher rates of alcohol abuse and addiction. Or is there another purpose to correlating these two identities, these two behaviors, such that over and over again, whether it's the 1920s, the 1940s, the 1960s, through different mechanisms each time, there are new explanations for why these groups, why these two things are correlated with each other. I just want to give you an example here of the kind of problem that I'm talking about. 1973, most of you know that homosexuality was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Diseases. And no, yes, that's definitely something we all want to celebrate. But unfortunately, there have been some unintended consequences to that process that may not have been so positive. And what I'm talking about is a bunch of research was produced to support the idea that homosexuality was not a mental illness, right? So Evelyn Hooker, one of our great heroes, conducted some studies comparing heterosexual men and homosexual men on a number of different mental health indicators. And she found that, in fact, there were no differences in mental health status between these two groups. Other people took up her research, and in the process of doing so, they said, let's examine, let's say, 10 different variables of mental health, including substance use, alcohol, and drug use. And when they found that, let's say, 3 out of those 10 variables showed that gay men were not doing as well mentally, let's say, than their heterosexual counterparts, they, in fact, exacerbated those findings, really drew them forward, highlighted them, exaggerated them in the results section. Meanwhile, ignoring, burying, changing the 7 variables that said, in fact, gay men have higher rates of help-seeking when they're depressed. Gay men have higher economic achievement, higher rates of finishing college. All of this was reported in their studies in 1973. But tell me the last time you've opened the newspaper or opened a medical journal, a psychological journal, and it says, gay men found to have higher rates of mental health than heterosexual counterparts. It won't appear. It won't be said. There are certain things that cannot be spoken in psychological and epidemiological literature. Why not? Is it because they're not true? No. It's not because they're not true. It's because we are invested in a process of finding the problems within our community in order to support the idea that homophobia exists. This is our bind. To prove that we suffer from homophobia, we have in fact had to continually reproduce the idea that our community is suffering, the idea that our community is facing all these problems, higher rates of suicide, higher rates of mental illness, higher rates of substance abuse, higher rates even of crystal meth, of alcoholism. And we have in fact worked ourselves into a corner, backed ourselves into a corner, so that it's not possible for us, within the realm, I'm speaking in a limited way, within the realm of scientific literature, for us to be well. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Dr. Gary Harper.
Good evening, everyone. I just want to talk briefly about two main factors. One is about our identities as gay men. I think that as gay men, kind of older gay men, I'll put myself in that category now as I get older and older every year and our students get younger and younger, is that I think that for a lot of gay men that growing up we had certain identities that we had to fulfill because there were restricted roles that we could have as being gay. I think that it for some people it may have restricted what kind of careers people have gone in, the way they lived their lives, where they lived, how they lived. And I think that we have to start to really stretch those boundaries and expand our notions of what it means to be both gay and what it means to be a man. Because regardless if you're gay, straight, bi, whatever, you're still a man. And I think that sometimes we put ourselves separate from straight men, and we're all men in the end. We all have penises. We all use them. We all do different things. No matter where we stick it, we're still having sex with people. So I think that we have to really look at ourselves as how we identify as men and the different ways in which we define ourselves as men, and then how we define ourselves as gay men. And I think that one thing that I definitely see in working with young people is that I'm always impressed with the different ways in which they're defining and redefining what it means to be gay and breaking out of stereotypical notions of what it means to be a gay kid or what it means to be a bi young man in different environments, different communities. And this gets more complicated when you throw in factors of race and ethnicity and socioeconomic status. And I think that we have a lot to learn from some of our younger brothers and the ways in which they're redefining what it means to be gay. And that plays into how we enact our sexuality, too. And I think that we get so caught up in dynamics of dichotomies of tops and bottoms. And that restricts, again, what we do. We have to do this or act this way if we're top, and do this and act this way if we're bottom. Well, screw that. We can do whatever we want to do because we're humans at the first level, we're men at the second level, and then we're gay or we're bi or however we want to define ourselves at a next level. And so I think we have to really, I think sometimes we put ourselves in those own boxes. And I think that oftentimes we look to the outside, how the outside people define us, and I think we need to look in our own house and see how we define ourselves internally and start to break us down some of those notions. I think that also in terms of sexuality, we need to be better at communicating about sex. Now, we're good about saying things about other people's sex lives or looking at people and talking about their bodies or their dicks or their chests or other things. But when it comes to talking about our own sexuality and our own sexual needs and our own sexual desires, we're at a loss for words. When we look at people, how they talk to each other oftentimes within a sexual context, there's a lot of assumptions made. So if you're a top, then I'm assuming you're going to do this or do that, or you're going to use a condom or not use a condom. There's so much unwritten dialogue that goes on without any words. And I think that, unfortunately, growing up, in a predominantly heterosexual society, all the images we see of sexuality are straight. We turn on the TV and we see males and females having sex and making out and doing this and doing that, but we don't really learn how to have a language of what it means to have sex with another man. We don't really learn how we can communicate our needs and our sexuality to other people in a healthy way. We spend so much time eroticizing and fantasizing that we forget that this is another human being with me here, and this person has needs and desires, and it's not just about getting my dick off, but it's about connecting with this person. Sometimes it's just about getting your dick off, but sometimes it's about really connecting with that person and finding a way to really share something very special with that person. And I think that we need to find ways to teach each other how to communicate and say, you know, I like that, I don't like that. You know, when you do that, that really hurts. Or, you know, I know you do this thing and I let you do it a while because I really liked you, but now that I know you more, I'm not doing that anymore. And just, you know, let people know what you want, because we're all humans, we're all people. We all have desires. No matter how much we want to pretend like we don't get aroused or, you know, in different situations, we all do. So let's just, you know, cut the bullshit, get down to learning how to talk to each other as men and as humans and respecting each other's bodies and each other's sexuality.
And then Dr. David Halperin, who came out with a fantastic new book, What Do Gay Men Want? An Essay on Sex, Risk, and Subjectivity.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you, Jim, for bringing me here and for organizing this meeting partly on the basis of my book. I guess I need to tell you what I've been interested in for the last 10 years or so. I've been kind of obsessed with the question of how people now think about and represent the inner lives of gay men, how we talk about our subjectivity. And I noticed, partly influenced by Michelle's work, I noticed that that although the topic of what goes on inside us and what it feels like to be gay is a topic that in some ways is more and more unfashionable nowadays, we much prefer to talk about our identity, how we suffer from discrimination, how we have claims to rights, rather than what it is that it's like to be the kind of subjects that we are. But there is one, it turns out, there is one topic that provides an excuse for a great deal of attention and thought to what it is that goes on inside us, and that's the topic of risky sex and why it is that so many of us are having so much sex that carries a risk of transmitting HIV. Now, it turns out that there is an entire cottage industry out there, mostly a psychological cottage industry, of people who are dedicating a lot of thought to trying to figure out what it is that goes on in our little minds that makes us behave so badly. Because the assumption is, since it is the case that rates of HIV infection are up in the U.S., they're up across the board, not just in the case of gay men, but there has been an increase in the rate of infection. If the CDC would just release its latest surveillance report for last year, we might know better exactly what the rate of increase is, but even the previous years have indicated some alarming numbers. And so there is something to worry about. But is it necessarily the case that what's going on is that gay people on the whole, gay men on the whole, have given up on gay sex, that they no longer care about protecting themselves, that they're blithely infecting their partners and themselves? A lot of work on what goes on in the inner lives of gay men that is inspired by these statistics about risk are premised on the notion that gay men are doing something irrational and self-destructive. And so there must be something wrong with us that explains why it is that we're behaving so badly, so unreasonably, and that it's the job of psychologists to find this out and then for activists to do something about it. And partly, I suppose I was inspired by the work done by friends of mine who are sociologists, as well as some good psychologists, who, for example, told me that in all the survey work they have done, and all the interviews they have done with, for example, gay men who have recently seroconverted, who have recently been infected, they encountered lots of guys who provided all sorts of explanations for what they thought was the reason they had been infected, what it is that they had done or that had happened to them. Never once, they told me, did they encounter anybody who said, well, I decided I wanted to be infected with HIV, or I decided to go out and get myself infected, or I decided I was going to infect as many people as I could. That they did not encounter. So I wanted to try to find out how we could think about risk-taking and how we could also think about the important values that gay men might try to actualize by taking certain kinds of risks, so that we could confront and talk about risk-taking without necessarily assuming that there was something terribly wrong with us or that what we were doing was self-destructive. On the contrary, it seems to me that what we are facing, and this is partly what I argue in the book, is that what we're facing is a situation in which a lot of people are trying to move beyond the old code of use a condom every time, and are trying to protect themselves by other means. Now, I suppose that if I could just, well, no, I was going to say, if I could just wave a magic wand and make everybody wear condoms, I would. But I don't think even that is something I would want to do, because there are all sorts of situations in which it makes perfect sense to have sex without condoms. If you are living with a partner of the same serostatus as you, and you know his status, and you trust each other, and you have been tested a bunch of times, and you are either not having sex with other people or you're having only protected sex with other people, then it does make perfect sense not to wear condoms when you have sex with each other. And people have been doing this, and sociologists and HIV social researchers have been documenting this practice for the last 15 years. Similarly, other people are trying other kinds of means of moving beyond condoms. Obviously, this involves a great deal of potential risk, and it's the sort of risk-taking that is best done when people are clear with each other about their assumptions, about their practices, about their expectations, and also when there can be some kind of collective discussion of what would be an acceptable level of risk for us as gay men to take. We should remember that safe sex, which is still the only really powerful solution to the epidemic, safe sex was invented by gay men in metropolitan centers in 1983, even before an infectious agent associated with HIV had been discovered. It was groups of gay men putting their heads together, figuring out what could possibly be going on, and taking steps to prevent the possible transmission of a pathogen, of a microbe, that led to the decision to use condoms for anal sex, even before the French had discovered HLTV3, as HIV was called at the time. So it seems to me that in similar ways, if we had enough opportunities to come together and to talk about what kinds of assumptions we would like to make, what kinds of levels of risk are acceptable, how, if we are going to move beyond condoms, we can do it without increasing the dangers to ourselves and to our partners, then it seems to me that would be a good thing to do. It's what I'm hoping will partly come out of this discussion tonight. It's why I'm so glad that Jim decided to organize this, and I hope we can have a good talk about these things.
So you guys got all that?
So, Dr. Michelle, so you were kind of like a detective. Can you talk to your microphone, sweetie? Get in there so we can hear your response. So you actually were kind of like in Law and Order, like, what's the name of that character on Law and Order that looks like you, Mark?
I don't know. Mr. Big.
Mr. Big, but it's like you were kind of like a detective going back and examining some of these studies and figuring out that they were actually swayed to sort of, why were they swaying them in the direction they were?
Right, I think that's a very good question. I think that to talk about heterosexuality as associated with risk seems to challenge the idea that it's normal. The same way that we can't talk about whiteness, for example, as being associated with any kind of negative health behavior, any kind of what I study research on college students. It's the same thing. We find that students who have come from higher income levels will have higher rates of drug use, but you won't find that study printed because there are certain ways that we protect the normative group from being associated with any behaviors that are negative. You think about one way to reinforce a kind of certain kinds of a negative identity, that's by correlating with other negative things. So there you find this chain of like prostitution is associated with drug use, is associated with crime, is associated with social class, is and on and on and on. So that even when heterosexual men, in fact, did have higher rates of some negative health behaviors, it cannot be drawn out, and it certainly cannot be associated with heterosexuality.
Michelle, what can we do to change that? What can we do to persuade psychologists to look at homosexuals as normal people and our behavior as normal?
Well, I think the change has to start with the disciplines of psychology and epidemiology, and that those cannot be the only fields that study health, right? Because you think epidemiology is the study of disease, so it's inherently stuck in a disease model. Now, psychology is starting to change thanks to great folks like Gary, and I don't mean to turn LGBT scientists or those folks who do this research into the bad guys, because certainly they are out on the front lines. And I know many people who will not put the studies that they do on gay sexuality on their CVs for fear that they will not get a grant. They will not be funded by the NIH. They will be blacklisted. So they are real. And if anybody who's applying to the NIH to do this research, who's applying for tenure, who's making a career out of that, is taking huge risks and should be celebrated for that work. However, we still are facing a problem.
So, I mean, it's like, everybody hears about these, rich white CEOs jumping out of airplanes, and I'm always making the joke, it's like, white people love to jump out of airplanes. And that's sort of seen as, heroic, right? It's like, oh my God, he jumped out of the airplane, and he almost died. What a hero. But, it's like, if you hear a friend talking, it's like, the passion was really hot, the sex was really hot, and I didn't use a condom. And you're like, Gary, why are we associating sort of heroism with some types of risky behavior and not, why isn't unprotected anal sex seen as heroic?
Mm-hmm. Or thrill-seeking.
Or thrill-seeking,
Why are people saying, wow, that's really incredible you did that?
It is thrill-seeking at some level. I mean, but it's not something, we don't put it in the same category as racing a car or jumping out of an airplane. I think it's a couple reasons. I think one is that anyone can have sex, and not anyone can jump out of an airplane. So in some ways, some of the high risky behaviors are associated with privilege. I mean, if you have the privilege to jump out of an airplane or race a car, there's a certain level of status or privilege you need to do that. So, and I think it goes back to what Michelle talked about, is that for groups who have privilege and power, that we tend to view them in a different way. I think also that oftentimes, unprotected sex or risky sexual behavior is also seen as a form of weakness and a lack of control, and that we're all in the U.S. society about controlling ourselves and controlling our sexuality. And so I think instead of seeing it as a positive, strength-based thing like jumping out of an airplane, it's seen as, oh, well, you lost control, or you were too weak, or, you gay people, you just can't control your dick, so you're just doing that and you can't really stop yourselves. So I think it has to do with multiple layers of just the way we view people that have power and privilege and what they can do, and then also some of the negativity that Michelle talked about how we just tend to, as a society, often demonize whatever acts gay men do.
Well, because you work with a lot of Hispanics and of color, African-American, mm-hmm. young people who are gay, And you were saying that they don't define themselves as being gay the way we do, the older generation, or maybe even, is it a race issue, or is it a generation thing?
I think there's two levels. I think there one is a generational issue. I think that gay youth, regardless of what ethnic or racial background they're from, live in a different society. They live in a society where there's images of gay people on TV. Now, we still have a long way to go, because not everyone is Will and Grace, but at least there's something out there, and there's some talk. And there's some talk in schools. So I think that youth in general, the generation gap, but then I think also that different ethnic groups view same gender sexuality in different ways. And so I think that some people are kind of creating their sexuality by paying attention to their ethnicity, but then also paying attention to their sexuality. And it creates an interesting tension of how they're going to be gay within a Puerto Rican context and how they're going to be gay within a youth context. So I think one thing we see is a lot of complexity.
And so what are we learning from, like, those sexy, hot, young Puerto Rican men like me?
Am I supposed to answer that?
Yeah. I mean, what are we learning exactly?
Well, I think what we're learning is that sexuality is extremely complex. And I think before, like Michelle again said, is that everything was about white folks. And so I think now we're realizing that ethnicity and class and many other factors have a large role in our sexuality, whether we're straight or gay or bi or whatever, and that we need to look at the complexity of our sexuality. It's not just one way. It's not just white sex or black sex. It's a very complex picture, and we need to spend time to really look at that and celebrate the diversity and not demonize or put people who look at it in a different way in a lower level.
Are the youth that you work with, are they using condoms? Are they practicing safe sex? How are the rates of infection?
Yeah, I mean, well, unfortunately, we're still seeing increasing rates of HIV infection among young gay men. If we look at it across years, we've seen decreases in females and increases in males, particularly among 13 to 19-year-olds. So there are still a lot of young men getting infected. But there are a lot of the young people that we talk to and that I work with, both here in Chicago and other places, though, are talking about condoms, and they're using condoms in different ways. But one thing that we've seen is that they're not always using them in the context of relationships. And they think, you know, in the adolescent mind, when you're 16 and you're in love, that's forever. And so, you know, taking the condom off because I love you and you love me and I trust you, we're seeing a lot of young people are getting infected within the context of a relationship. It's not they're going out and screwing their brains out with everyone, but they're really in love and they really think that this person has their best interest, and that's how a lot of them are getting infected.
So David, I mean, we were talking that you were suggesting that maybe a possibility might be for healthcare organizations to turn to HIV positive people and say, you know, you can use you don't have to use a condom every single time.
With another HIV
positive person. And that can sort of be contradictory because we've been all being told, wear a condom, wear a condom. How come?
Oh, well, I mentioned that the San Francisco Department of Public Health had a campaign that they started promoting about a year and a half ago that said something like what was it called? Yeah, but what zero selection is safe sex? What was the slogan?
Zero selection is safe sex.
No, it was called disclosure, and it said something like partner selection is safe sex, or something like that. So the Department of Public Health in San Francisco was actually promoting zero sorting as a prevention technique.
Aren't they going to create some kind of crazy super HIV bug that's just going to take over the world then?
Super bug syndrome.
Apparently not. There's no evidence of it. There's no evidence that people who have been fully infected with HIV, who've been infected, say, after a period of 2 or 3 years with one strain of HIV-1, can then go on to be infected with another strain of HIV-1. That seems not to be happening from what I am told by the virologists who are studying this. Even some of the published reports indicate that kind of additional infection, which is called superinfection, is rare, that there were something like 16 cases reported worldwide between 16 cases reported in the entire world between 2002 and 2005. So although clinicians, doctors are not telling their HIV-positive patients to have unprotected sex with other HIV-positive guys, on the whole, places like the Department of Public Health are encouraging it. There is such a thing as reinfection, which has to do with being infected with more than one strain of HIV-1 during a period in which you were transitioning from being negative to being positive. So if you're having a lot of unprotected, if you're negative, if you're having a lot of unprotected sex with a bunch of different HIV-positive people, it might be possible to be infected with more than one strain at the same time.
So isn't that a contradiction of the idea
But I don't think he knows what, HIV-positive. They don't know their status at the time, though, is what you're saying.
At the time, who knows why they're doing it? I'm just saying that it is possible to be infected with more than one strain of HIV-1, apparently. I'm not an expert on it, but apparently. Mm-hmm. During a single window of vulnerability. But if you've been infected with one strain of HIV and that virus has taken up a home in your body and has established itself, after a certain period, it's extremely unusual to be infected with another strain of HIV-1. I mean, you're more likely to be killed by a car on the way to the house of the guy you're having sex with than to be, right? I mean, you have to keep these kinds of risks within perspective.
Right. And doctor, so an HIV-positive person can have sex with another HIV-positive person, as long as presumably they're taking their medications, and it's fine, and it's safe. So have you seen, is there like a change in a lot of these HIV-positive persons' outlook on sex? Are they looking more, has the behavior changed at all?
I don't know about that, but it seems, and some of you here can probably talk about that, and I think we probably should stop mm-hmm. talking ourselves.
Okay, we'll take it up.
And let people speak. But certainly one of the things we witnessed over the past 15 years has been, with PAWS magazine and other things, has been the rise of a real culture of HIV-positive sexuality out there, open and vibrant.
But are we seeing sort of like a contradiction in what some of these organizations and studies told us in the past? And Michelle, I mean, is this sort of tie into what you have been studying, which is that a lot of researchers are looking at studies and sort of coming up to a conclusion because they're going by intuition and not by hard science? Michelle.
Yeah, I because this is out of my area of expertise, I really don't want to speak to that. I can say that I think we have to approach scientific studies with a level of suspicion or a caution is probably the best word. It's only when a number of studies have shown the same thing and it's been investigated over and over that I think we can have more faith in what the findings are.
So let's open up to some of the questions. I see some of your faces in the audience here that are going, it's like, sort of not agreeing with what's being the idea that's being presented here. If you want to raise your hands and say where you're from and what your name is, that would be really helpful. So wait for Mark to come up to you.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm a volunteer at the Center on Halsted. And it's kind of different when people say, using a condom feels weird. It doesn't feel natural. Maybe if we educate those people, what feels more weird and more unnatural is living with HIV and catching the disease. And I think what's missing possibly is the spirituality, the essence of much more than research, much more than survey, much more than a condom. And I think Center on Halsted is working on that, and I'm so grateful for this forum.
Thank you. Does anybody have a question?
Do you guys want to respond to that at all, Gary?
Well, I would just say one thing, too. I think that if we look at HIV prevention programs earlier in the epidemic, we really didn't talk about eroticization of condom use and about the fact that sex is fun and sex is erotic. And so, yeah, I mean, people talk about, ooh, what's this, this piece of latex, but we need to talk about how to make sex exciting and arousing, even if latex is involved. It doesn't have to be a complete barrier to pleasure. Yeah, it's going to be different. It's not going to feel exactly the same thing. But yeah, and a part of that has to do with just our views of sexuality. I mean, we still live in a puritanical society where we can't talk about sex in an open way. Come on, we had a Surgeon General that was kicked out because she talked about masturbation. And we
now
have
we
a
found out that it prevents prostate cancer.
Right, exactly. You know? And we have a CDC that takes all information about condoms off of its website when the Bush administration comes in. So, you know, we live in a sex-phobic society, and we need to have programs where we talk about how fun and exciting sex can be, because it is fun. Why else do we do it?
So, David, you brought up the disclosure campaign in San Francisco. I guess before he died, Eric Rofus suggested that social marketing was a colonizing force in gay men's sexual lives, and that it should be sort of abandoned as a practice for doing prevention. And so I wonder what your take generally on sort of, because social marketing is sort of inherently about sort of reshaping norms that are out there, what your take on social marketing as a prevention tool is.
Well, you know, my image of the gay community was formed in San Francisco. It's where I came out in the 70s. And that was a world in which, you know, when Harvey Milk is given a light sentence, all of a sudden you have like 50,000 people in the street at once because you have a concentration of people in one place. And I think the challenge now, whether it's social marketing or anything else, is to try to find venues such as this one and media outlets such as the Windy City Times and other local papers.
The Feastables podcast.
Or your podcast. Or other locations on the internet in which these kinds of communal discussions can take place. Because I think we need places in which to be able to figure out these problems collectively.
So Mr. Jim Pickett here wants to talk about microbicides.
I just need to run my mouth for a few seconds. Those of you who know me have heard the word microbicides before, but really speaking to this idea of natural sex and not liking condoms, actually it's natural to not like condoms. When heterosexuals have natural sex, we applaud them and have a baby shower. When gay people have natural sex, we hiss and scream. So I'm really interested, and there's a whole field of research that's happening around new prevention technologies called microbicides. I have a little report up here called Less Silence. Yeah, Less Silence, More Science, making a rectal microbicide advocacy a reality, or making rectal microbicides a reality. A rectal microbicide would be a gel or a lubricant, maybe an enema, that would have anti-HIV properties in it. You would use this before or after sex, and it could provide protection against HIV in the absence of condoms. So this is a major thing. We have vaginal microbicides.
So this is different than nonoxynil 9, which people are thinking, yeah. This is nonoxynil 9.
N9, bad. N9 is a microbicide. We thought of, several years ago, there was this idea that it killed HIV in test tubes, so let's put it on condoms and put it in lubricants. No, very bad. There's actually still condoms that have N9 in them, Trojans being one of them. Stay away from anything that says N9. This is a microbicide that actually, I don't need to be scientific here, it like eats up your booty. And if you use this, it's going to create pathways for HIV to enter into your body. So we're looking at safe, acceptable, and effective microbicides that would not harm you and that would also protect you. There's vaginal research for the front, for the ladies, and there's rectal microbicide research for the back door, which we all have. And ladies happen to have a lot of backdoor sex, by the way. It's not just gay men. In the U.S.
Yeah, let's hear it for anal sex.
And let's talk about... And it's not just for cougars. I've been very obsessed with cougars.
For some of the people who don't know, cougars is a mature woman who is attracted to younger men.
Like Demi Cougar Mellencamp? So, okay, I'm going to finish up because this is about your time. But U.S. ladies actually have 7 times more anal sex than gay men, because not in terms of how often, but in terms of numbers, because there's a lot more ladies than gay men, and they have anal sex rather frequently. So we need to have these products. Do they exist yet? No, they're in research. We don't have a safe and effective vaginal microbicide. We do not have one for the booty, but we're working on it. Please pick up a copy of this, take it home and memorize it, and get involved. And if you're interested in more information about it, contact me and I'll hook you up. That's it.
So,
done.
Jim, I mean,
I'm getting the hook from Mark over there. I can see.
No, but
see
I'm right here. I want to ask this. It's like, because it really, this is kind of a technological issue in the sense that we need to develop new devices and tools for us to protect ourselves from sexually transmitted diseases. If you can put Man on the Moon on your iPod, why can't we create new condoms, new lubes, new gels that protect us from
that's these
things?
And why have we been happy with one way to protect ourselves? Why have we been saying condoms are enough? No, they're not.
Does anybody know when condoms were actually developed? I was like, is it a
yes.
World War II?
But you know, let me just...
And the answer is?
I have another favorite thing I like to say, so if you've heard it before, just, you know, how many of us, if we walked into a Starbucks or a Caribou or a Seattle's Best, and we walked in there and all there was one kind of coffee, drip coffee, what would we do? We would freak out.
You'd be like, is that going to be $8?
We would be, it would be a disaster. There would be a revolution. So we need to have more options. We need to have a safe sex buffet where we get to choose different things that work for us. Maybe, you know what, honey, if condoms work for you, fabulous. They're the most effective things we have, and likely they will be the most effective things we ever have. When used consistently and correctly, they're 98% effective. But not everyone can use them, everyone wants to use them, so we have to have other choices. So, you know, start paying attention to new prevention technologies, and when you have the opportunity, advocate for them. The marketplace will determine whether we have these things. The marketplace determined that we will have 150 frickin' kinds of cappuccino. The marketplace can also determine that we will have 100 kinds of microbicides or other new prevention technologies.
But you know what? But you know what, Jim? I want to add to that. It's like if scientists developed a condom that makes your dick bigger, everybody would buy one and wear it. So the thing is that it's like, and it's kind of silly to say something like that, but I think it's, the important point is to make is that we're stuck with condoms that were developed when? How many years ago?
Starting in the 1840s.
Okay? It's 2008, you know? Give me, all the people that are working on the new iPod, get them to start working on the new condom.
Seriously.
Okay.
All right, so enough.
Actually, it's more of a comment. I think that we need to be very careful about what choices we make when we come up with this variety of safer sex methods, especially when it comes to the information behind those safer sex methods. For instance, I still have to do more research, but from what I understand, HIV is a virus that you can have many strains in your system at any time, and it's also a virus that can be recombinant, so it can recombine with other strains of the virus. So there's no, well, I have to speak personally here, but I don't think there's any way we should say that it's perfectly okay for those of us who are positive to have sex without any condoms all the time or whenever. I think we should be very careful about that, because if those viruses do recombine, then we will have a stronger form of the virus.
So it's the superbug. Is there a possibility for the superbug?
Does anybody want to address that?
I think that's an excellent point. I think also when you have unprotected sex, you also have the possibility of other sexually transmitted infections. And other STIs are going to make your HIV worse. You know, if you're getting continual STIs, that's going to make your CD4 counts go down, your viral loads could go up. So there's a lot of other things out there, too. And you can have drug-resistant strains. So if you've burned yourself out on a particular regimen because of noncompliance, and then you pass a drug-resistant strain on, then you've passed that on to that other person. So I think that we do have to look at the complexity of what can be passed during those unprotected episodes.
Well, so is the message here, HIV-positive people, it's okay to use not to use condoms? Or is the message here, you should always use condoms?
I think it needs to be nuanced. Frankly,
so there is no,
I think Dr. Halperin, you disagree, or some people are saying there's actual science behind it that's saying if you are HIV positive and you're having sex with HIV positive and you are in a regimen, you are really not at any more risk than negative people.
I sort of want you to stop calling me doctor because I'm not I don't have an MD. I have a PhD. I'm not a virologist. But I think it's and I certainly respect your view. And since I don't know the science, you may know more about it than I do. I'm not going to contest it. It just seems remarkable to me that the San Francisco Department of Public Health, would promote condomless sex among HIV-positive men as a safe sex alternative. And influenced, no doubt, by things like the positive partner study in San Francisco, in which local virologists have been following HIV-positive guys and have been looking for evidence of dangerous kinds of superinfection, and so far have not been finding evidence of it.
And I also just want to point out that there is something for HIV-positive people, when your viral load is undetectable, you are much less likely to pass on your strain. You're not probably going to. And actually, you know, we're starting to look at, and I know this is going to probably have a few clutch the pearl moments, but there are people of different seral statuses, and depending on, we're calling this seral adaptation. So they're choosing roles during sex based on their seral status. For instance, the HIV positive guy, and they want to have unprotected sex. So the HIV positive guy is the bottom, the HIV negative guy is the top. There's much less likely transmission that's going to go from the HIV positive guy to the negative guy because of the roles that they're playing, and also the role of a viral load. If your viral load is undetectable, it is much less likely that you're going to pass on a strain. We don't often talk about these things, but if you're in treatment, you're less likely to pass on HIV, whatever kind of sex you're having.
There's a new study out of Switzerland that looked at this that got a lot of attention a few months ago, and it was mostly with heterosexuals. It's not clear how well it applies to gay men. And we do know that even if you have an undetectable viral load in your bloodstream, you can still have HIV in semen. So, I wouldn't leap to any conclusions about this, but you can see that in the context of a relationship, an HIV-positive guy with an undetectable viral load might well let himself be fucked by his HIV-negative partner, because in this case, the partner isn't encountering semen from his HIV-positive partner if that partner is the bottom in the role. So you can see why people are trying these different things, and I think this is the kind of experimentation with sexual practices that gave us safe sex to begin with and has also given us the behavior adaptations to oral sex that we've seen in gay communities around the world now for a couple of decades.
So are you saying that we need to be more subtle in the way and experimental in the way we deal with HIV and AIDS, that we're not doing?
Well, I think gay men are already involved in massive life experiments.
So your body's a little chemistry set.
Well, I think it has been. I mean, you know, if we now think, as I think lots of people do, that oral sex without ejaculation is not a very risky behavior, it's not because the CDC told us we could practice it. It's because groups of gay men in metropolitan centers have been experimenting with it and have, on the whole, found that the risk involved is acceptable to them.
My name is Booker, and I live in Chicago. And I'm a facilitator and a volunteer at TPAN. I would like to say that I think that alcohol and those who use controlled substances are getting a bad rep. It's because I just can't see that how these substances can control you to a different person. I just cannot see that Margaret Thatcher of former Prime Minister of England getting high and resorting to colloquial expression and vulgarity.
So are you saying that you can't imagine Margaret Thatcher getting high and being vulgar?
I'm sure she may
have. I can imagine her doing that.
I can see it. I can totally see it.
It's something you want to do in the first place.
There have been some studies that show that people who have unsafe sex under the influence of substances also have unsafe sex when they're not under the influence of substances.
I'm Scott. I'm from Chicago. And this is something that I'd like each of the panelists to give their individual specialty on in brief. As an HIV-positive man, there's one thing I'm not hearing here, and that is the perspective of straight and HIV-negative gay men demonizing HIV-positive men. And anybody who is positive knows that this is a fact, that that we walk around, and unless we disclose our status, we're like everybody else. And then when we disclose our status, we are different, and we are ostracized and rejected. And where that seems to fall down is under the influence of a chemical. And that's where people kind of change their minds. Oh, you don't look that bad. Oh, you don't look sick. You don't look unhealthy, and you're hot. Oh, yeah, fuck me. And that's something that I'd like you to address, please.
Well, I'm happy to start since we got everyone's a little. You see, you know, doctors and researchers, they have to speak to exactly what they've studied or known or have. You know, I can just run off at the mouth because I have no degree. I'm a college dropout. And I'm HIV positive, so I can speak to this on a personal level. I totally hear you. I think there is sort of this idea that all the onus is on gay positive men to disclose and be always the responsible one, and negative guys are kind of off the hook. We all have equal responsibility when we come to a sexual union. So it takes two people to have unprotected sex. It takes two people to decide to have safe sex. A lot of us use substances as a sort of a post facto rationalization. We already want to have that behavior, and then we go out and get fucked up, and that now gives us a good excuse for, oh my God, I was so fucked up. You know, I had unsafe sex. Well, they had already. It was already planned. It was already in motion. The drug or the alcohol just was a great excuse to help you have that. I think we all just need to talk more. And I really believe that, you know, negative men, positive men, we all just need to take responsibility for ourselves. And when we're together, if we're going to get horizontal with people, we need to have a vertical conversation beforehand, you know, with bright fluorescent lights on, without any mood music, and be clear about where we stand, what we want to do, what we don't want to do, what our statuses are, what we're comfortable with, what we're not. We're not very good at doing that, but we need to do more of that. And we all need to take responsibility and ownership for that. It's not just positive, guys. And that's, a lot of times it gets put on us. And I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way.
But Jim, nobody wants to be labeled a whore. And it's like, you know, and if you start talking about these things, some of us do.
Raise your hand.
Well, okay.
Whores.
But let me explain. Whores, everybody.
Oh, the rest of you are liars.
There's only two kinds, whores and liars. But even then, even those who are proud of being whores, sometimes when you're on that date with that guy and you're going, I really, really want him to like me, and I'm just scared if I tell him I'm a whore, that he's going to reject me.
Well, what are we? Is it whore or being HIV positive? I mean, I think on your first date, yeah, is it uncomfortable to be, you know, when you want to be talking about like the pretty walk along the lake and you have to have an HIV discussion? I don't think you have to have the disclosure discussion right away. If you guys end up having sex, there's lots of things you can do that have no HIV risk. It's not always about disclosure. You can do a lot of things that don't put you at risk or your partner for HIV acquisition.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think if you look at our public health system, you look at the programs that the CDC is producing for prevention, we separate prevention for positives, and then the rest is assumed prevention for negatives. And I think that's a problem right there, because we're all part of the same community. We're all having sex with each other. And so I think that we have to look at the higher institutional levels, because I think that's where a lot of the demonization occurs. And then people are just enacting that out. And that we do have to look at our programs and find ways to bring positive and negative men together and to work toward the common goal of really building the community. And I think that we, you know, unfortunately, by looking at this as a disease and a vector of disease, that furthers that demonization. And we need to look at it as a larger social issue and not necessarily just a virus. Because HIV is about a lot more than a virus. It's about multiple systems of oppression and racism and classism and everything. So as long as we keep calling it a disease and a bug, the person who has the bug is bad, who doesn't is good. And that's the notion we have to get rid of in order to break down some of that.
And can we just, and also in terms of gay men's health, it's a lot more than HIV.
Yes,
it's a lot
exactly.
more than being,
yeah, exactly.
We're a lot more than navel to knee.
Right.
We're not just vectors of disease
right.
and pathology.
Exactly.
And I think we have to start to address HIV properly. We have to address gay men's health holistically.
Right.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you're saying some of the obstacles that we face as gay men today comes from our inability to honestly and openly talk about our sexual desires. I mean, I don't want to believe in cosmic retribution, but some of these diseases, in a sense, can be fought by talking about it. Mm-hmm.
Part of the point of safe sex when it was invented in the early 80s was to avoid this very problem. That is to say, don't ask me if I'm negative or positive. Most people didn't know at the time. We have safe sex. We don't worry about it. As long as we're having safe sex, I don't need to ask you about it. When we had testing and then, viral load numbers and so forth, we have these new techniques that have, in effect, produced a new kind of HIV apartheid. And I think we can't hope to have to succeed at prevention if we stigmatize HIV positive people, and that means if gay people as a whole don't take collective ownership of HIV.
My name's Drew, and I'm pretty new to Chicago. I went to U of M, so it's very nice to have you, Dr. Halpern. I'd just like to say that my partner of 3 years was HIV positive, and I'm still negative at this point, but what it was about open communication. It was about using, no offense, I agree with what you're saying. We need to look at, safe sex in many different avenues and corridors, but it was about using condoms and about being protective and about doing things that we knew were safe, where I could be comfortable with him, when we could express our sexuality, but also when it came down to really, hitting it, just being careful and using condoms. So I think I don't think it's about demonization. I don't, just personally, being with someone who is going through something, who has HIV, I never looked at his demonization. He never did either.
Hi, my name is Robert. I'm from Chicago, and I'd appreciate no pictures. I think one point that hasn't been raised, I think it's a generational issue. People, those of us who are 45 to 65, had friends who died, lots of friends who died. Guys who are 15 to 35, to them, AIDS is a manageable disease. Mm-hmm. So we've used terms calling it a manageable disease, which allows young guys to think that this is just something I could live with. This is just taking some pills, like vitamins. Mm-hmm. And it's not that at all. My background is advertising and promotion. The idea of just the term barebacking, the whole, it's become an erotic thing, it's become a mystifying thing. It's really wrong, and it's very, very harmful to the younger generation. And they have to be talked, I think, they ought to be talked to in a much different way than we're even talking now. This is just skirting. We're kind of talking to each other, but we're not getting to the real point. I would hope that you would have discussions, real discussions, with guys who are 35 and under, because they don't have a clue.
Well, let me ask, do the people, our people you work with, you, do people say out and say, I'm going to go out and get a manageable disease?
I mean, I agree with you. I'm in the 45 to 60 range. And I think that it is a different world now than it was back then. And I think that for the young people that I work with, you're right. You see the ads, and I think, talking about advertisements, all the drug ads have very sexy, very hot men in them that look healthy. They look great. We're really, I think that it's a double-edged sword, because we don't want to stigmatize people who are living with HIV, and we don't want to say, okay, you're going to die right away. So there's this promotion of positive images. But then for younger folks who weren't privy or didn't have to live through some of those horrific times, they do see it as something where you pop two or three pills a day, and especially with dosing being decreased more and more, and it does become a challenge. I've never heard any young men that I work with say, okay, I'm going to go get a manageable disease, but it's about making risk assessments. We make a risk assessment every day. When I chose to drive here, I made a risk assessment about my likelihood of getting in an accident. And so if we're talking about the likelihood of getting a disease where I take a couple of pills versus the likelihood of doing something else that may be seen as more time-consuming, more damaging, it's a very different analysis. And I think that we do have to talk to young people differently, because, when I teach a class on HIV at DePaul, I have for the past 10 years, we show them in the band Played On. That's like mind-blowing to them. They've never seen that before. And so I think that we do have to approach it differently, because it's a different issue. It's a different social issue now than it was 20 years ago.
Good evening. My name is Peacock, community advisor to HIV.
And I want to say, first of all, Jim, it was very good that you brought up the microbicides. But more than that, see, I wanted to let everybody know, first of all, I'm not gay, but my lover is, you know? And so, you know, we're all looking at ourselves different these days. You know, some of us are gay. Some of us are just same gender loving. So why not is it that we can all come together and look at ourselves? We're at a new millennium. Ugh. And you know, we're letting they describe us instead of we describing ourselves. So what can we do to let them know, you know, stop describing us, we can describe ourselves.
My name is David. I work with Howard Brown. I live in Merrill's Park. I don't live in Chicago, sorry. I hear a lot of questions or the discussion about sex, safe sex, barebacking, so forth and so on. I think one of the things that we're missing is that we're not talking about or reinforcing loving, caring relationships. I think that's one thing that's missing in our community is that we don't talk about how do we grow and develop and maintain great relationships so we don't have to worry about going out and getting something. That if I'm in a caring, supportive, and validated relationship, the chances of me catching something are slim to none because I'm supported by not only my community, but everyone around me. So I think that's where, I mean, I'm hearing like safe sex, safe sex, but that's good. Like, sex is great, but relationships are even better because it can kind of like help you to protect yourself even more. And I think we're missing that. We're not talking about that.
Relationships are better if they work. But in a way, the greatest risk factor, one of the greatest risk factors for HIV transmission is love. So we also have to bear that in mind.
The number one risk factor for women in the world for acquisition of HIV is marriage.
Marriage, yeah.
So I think we all need to just be, you know, I think relationships are great if that's what you want. I mean, there's a lot of ways to protect ourselves, and we shouldn't look at relationships as being protective. It's about how you communicate with each other. If you have outside sex, what kind of sex you have, how honest you are with each other. And there are people who don't want to have relationships. There are people who want to be single, and they should, you know, there's ways for themselves to protect. They should be able to protect themselves just as well as someone in a relationship. Right.
I just want to add something to that, though. I mean, I do agree with you, though, that I think that part of what makes a relationship challenging is that, again, we don't have a whole lot of role models for healthy, positive relationships among two men. And especially, again, for youth coming up, you know, we don't have loving, caring relationships between two men that they see in schools or on TV or anything else, you know? And so And I think that people who are in those relationships, I think that it's a personal choice, like Jim said. Some people choose to be in relationships and some don't. Some people may be having sex because they want a relationship, but because of stigma, oppression, them not being able to be out in their community, they may not be able to engage in that, so they may turn to sex. I think there's different reasons. But I think we do have, it's a basic human need. I mean, with the young people that we work with, they talk about wanting someone to love. They want a boyfriend. They want the white picket fence. They want to hold hands, you know, and we do need to talk about that. I think that's a good point.
Question, sir?
Sure. My name is Rich. I live in Chicago. I think that it's important. It's kind of been skirted around, but we've talked about HIV negative, positive, but certainly, and to state it out loud, there is syphilis. Those rates, as I understand, are going up. Certainly herpes, other things that are out there. And it's important to stress, of course, that we shouldn't live in fear. There's no reason to live in fear. Sex can be very joyful. If nothing else, it can feel very good. As a librarian, I guess what I would contribute is the emphasis on information. Mm-hmm. Certainly the information is out there. I think we can look at ways to get it out there better. But we also have to take it upon ourselves to inform ourselves. If the information isn't out there, then go on the internet, go to the library, talk to one another, talk to your doctor to find out more information.
Fantastic. Can we hear some comments or questions about drug use in our community? Because we're running out of time, and I really wanted to cover that topic a little bit.
Well, are we running out of time?
Let me just get him.
Oh, my name is Bob.
I
live in the fragile system called planet Earth, and I'm a person who has a love relationship with the laws of physics. Now, when I was growing up, I read a book called Aerosmith by Sinclair Lewis, which talked about the relative importance of researching the causative factors of an epidemic while the epidemic was raging. As if we extract this to modernity, I see very little interest in understanding the causative factors underlying the propagation of HIV into AIDS. It's very important to pursue this with the same vigor that we pursue the treatment and prevention methodology. So I'm very dismayed that I never see any interest whatsoever in this community in pursuing that type of work, which is so necessary, really. I firmly believe in my heart and soul that the laws of physics are sufficient to understand the causative factors of AIDS, and I would like to see more support in this community for pushing forward to more work in this area. I'm very dismayed that I see no such impetus whatsoever. It doesn't mean everyone has to become a physicist, but we have to be willing to support this type of work more and not just be concerned with the prevention methodology.
Let's hear about drugs.
My name's Steve. I live in Andersonville. And my question about drugs and HIV contraction rates is, you know, we're hearing a lot out there about crystal meth use and things like that, but you know, if you read Craigslist just for the pictures like some of us do, you see a whole lot of stuff on there about poppers and 420, and, you know, those people say, well, no PNP, but popper friendly. You know, I'm like, what the hell is that? Because, you know, they're like, well, do you have poppers? I'm like, you know, to the point that you don't actually do them, but you keep them just in case if somebody wants them. I'm like, what's up with that?
Again, a double bind between walking the line between the traditional prevention message that all of you are familiar with that comes out that's very dogmatic, which is to say, stay clean, don't do drugs, watch your alcohol, protect yourself, be careful.
Cut it out.
Yeah, essentially, right, cut it out. And David and I have had many difficult conversations about this. And I think part, sort of following off of his work, in asking what are people really doing, that we need to sort of back up and say, are there ways in which people are using drugs and maybe also keeping themselves safe? Are there ways in which drug users are being demonized that we need to be careful about? Are there, following up on the demonization question, and I think this is an extremely difficult conversation to have and that there isn't one answer. You know, for some folks, recovery is absolutely the way to go. For some folks, using the decision to use is a decision that happens way before the actual event of using, right? The seemingly unimportant decisions, like the not getting enough sleep 3 days before, right? Having a painful, traumatic experience on and on and on that leads to the act of using. And that looking at those things might result in someone making a different choice. With all of that said, are there ways that people can use drugs and not have consequences? Sorry.
Talk into your microphone because they can't hear you at home.
Or put another way, I guess, are there ways in which we can have this conversation without pointing the finger and without allowing our community to perpetuate this sort of demonization? I mean, when the New York Times takes out a huge ad that says, you know, crystal meth is gay men and crystal meth, what kind of message is that sending out to the general public? We care about crystal meth, yes, but also, what are there ways in which we're letting the prevention message, in fact, increase other people's fear or increase our own fear about ourselves? So I hope that.
And you know, just to quickly speak to the crystal meth issue here in Chicago. We had an issue with it that was really, you know, highly prevalent in the media. We talked about it. We formed a crystal meth task force. We had a website, crystalbreaks.org. What many people maybe didn't realize that the vast majority of people, gay men in the city of Chicago, have never used crystal and don't use crystal. 90%, according to our best stats right now, don't use crystal and haven't used crystal. So there's 10% that do. That 10% is important, but that's not a majority. That's a minority. And of that 10%, only a handful have used it in the last week. So this is based on a study of like 1,200 people. It's pretty representative. It's not to diminish anyone's experiences with it, but it's to say that there's more nuances and to be skeptical of the things you read and hear and to not immediately go for the jugular or clutching the pearls.
And also to know that there are healthier ways to take drugs and to use substances. We've been doing it from the beginning of time. Some of us are going to do it at Sidetrack after this. Seriously. And let's stop looking at the crystal user. Let's look at ourselves in the mirror and say, what kind of substances do we use? Is anyone in this room substance free?
Well, is this a question that image of the skull and the face, you know, do you guys, death, meth equals death. And of course it's targeted to gay. So in a sense, Michelle is like, gay equals death. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like, you know, everybody's like, I look at the responses on people's faces here. It's like, ooh, you know. Are we needing, what is the proper message? How are we sensationalizing crystal meth use? Is it that we're just sort of like to see people in power fall? And part of our fascination with crystal meth is that in recent times we saw gay men in positions of power at different types of health service organizations be revealed that they were crystal meth addicts. And it's like the very scandalous story of Michael. They're on trial right now. Michael L. Jackson is the poster child for that. And part of our fascination that is not going to be very healthy, right? Let's hear over there.
Well, I'm glad to know that the story of Mike Jackson lives on.
What's your name?
My name is Joe Franklin. I represent Heartland Human Care Services and also North Star Healthcare. I'm a substance abuse therapist, and I've been providing services to gay men for about 5 years now. My question goes back to the doctor from Evanston earlier. When you spoke about evidence-based research conclusions, that really has been perpetuated over the last 30 to 40 years, where the negative outcomes have been exacerbated. These are obviously peer-reviewed studies that people have put their stamp of approval on. I'm curious to know, from your opinion, knowing that we have to use those very same numbers in order to write SAMHSA grants, to write NIDA grants, to fund programs like we have through Heartland Alliance and other programs, how do we go about balancing the fact that within the LGBT community, we do have higher rates of substance abuse, we do have higher rates of domestic violence? These are facts, these are truths that our community must know about. How do we go about balancing that and also providing good messages for treatment and prevention within the community without further stigmatizing mm-hmm. our community and mm-hmm. ourselves?
I think that's an excellent question. I'm really glad you raised it. I appreciate that. I think it is exactly, the answer is in your question, which is we try and find a balance. So when we say we do know that there are higher rates of substance use in our community, that's a generalized statement that can be broken down into its component parts, which is to say, in fact, gay men have lower rates of alcoholism than heterosexual men. That is also a fact. Now, in Chicago, rates of crystal meth addiction might be higher, but we need to be able to print the studies that, in fact, that show the opposite to what we're used to seeing, so that there is a balanced and a nuanced position. We have higher rates of tobacco use among LGBT youth, for sure, right? But one of the most interesting kind of manipulations that's happening is that because lesbian and bisexual women have been found to have higher rates of alcoholism over time, well, that's actually diminishing. But what researchers are doing is saying any woman who's had any kind of experience with a woman ever in her lifetime is getting grouped into that group of lesbian and bisexual women, whether they identify or not, whether it was one experience when they were 15, they're now 45, they are being put in the group of lesbian and bisexual women so that we can continue the idea that they have higher rates of alcoholism. So there are all these manipulations of the data that need to stop to start with. And then I think we will get a more balanced picture. One more thing, back on the crystal meth thing, and this might seem to be opposite of what I was saying. You know, I was part of a postdoc group with a bunch of pharmacologists who do a number of studies on crystal meth, and they this is common knowledge, but one of the ways that pharmacologists can tell a drug's addictive property is by doing a kind of rat behavioral control study. So they will train the rat to push a lever to administer the drug, right? And however many times the rat will push the lever, tells us something about how addicted the rat can become. Now, of course, there are huge problems with all these drug studies being done on rats and then the comparison being made to humans. But it is interesting to note that, for example, with cocaine, a rat will push the lever around 200 to 220 times in order to get an administration of cocaine. Now, that's going to do some damage to the rat. With crystal meth, that number jumps up to about double. So it's about 420 times the highest of any drug that's been studied, that the rat will push the lever with its face to the point where it, in fact, will begin to self-destruct. And its nose and its mouth, you know, become sort of mangled and bloody. Does that mean, I wanted to put that out there, which is to say, it's not that I'm aware that crystal meth isn't dangerous. Does that? But most people who try it do not become addicted.
420 times.
We got a wrap.
420. 420. Is that Rosanna? And those of you who are laughing, don't say that you don't use any drugs, because if that made sense to
but
you.
It's 420.
That's 420. We want to thank so much give a round of applause to our special guests, Dr. Michelle Morales, Dr. Gary Harper, and Dr. David Halpern for coming today.
And that is our live podcast forum from the Center on Halsted. Remember, you can visit our website, feastoffools.net, and post your comments and thoughts on the opinions expressed in the show. And the Feast of Fools was brought to you by generous support of fabulous listeners like you and by lifelube.org.
The gay, sexy health blog chock full of the sticky stuff that keeps us all of us together and moving forward. Lifelube.blogspot.com. For a good time, click Life Lube early and often.
Thank you so much for coming and joining us. Remember that you can always subscribe to the Feast of Fools podcast on the iTunes Music Store. Never miss an episode. Just type in Feast of Fools and click subscribe.
Mm-hmm. And follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/feastoffools. And you can get up-to-the-minute details on what we do to bring this show from our hearts to your ears.
Do you know we have Feast of Fools t-shirts and mugs? Yes, fabulous t-shirts and mugs. For a small fee, you can help support the world's most fabulous podcast, The Feast of Fools. I'm Fausto Furnos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Reflection shines like a light. If I had a say in what you do, you'd put your love right into my heart. It would be there inside like you. It would not matter where you are. The fever in my heart is the lifeline to you. The fever in my heart is the start. The fever in my heart is the lifeline to you. The fever in my heart is the start. You're like the falling winter air. You feel so cool, you feel so alive. I want to spend the waking day to rest my soul.